even though I grew up in California, we came to Coachella every summer to see Grandma and Grandpa Piper. I remember Grandma telling me that the Meadowlarks sing, "Coakville's a pretty little town," and I never disagreed. I'm happy to share with you today a few thoughts on my grandmother's Western art. About art theory. I wasn't interested in that when I was a child and then I had a teenager in Coachville. And I many times wished that I could talk to her now. Minerva Typert was 9 months younger than the artist George O'Keefe. In the spring of 1916, O'Keefe was in New York City beginning her relationship with her mentor, the photographer and promoter of modern art, Alfred Stieglitz. At the same time, Minerva Typert was in New York taking leave of her teacher and friend Robert Henlein. Typert and O'Keefe had both been raised in rural communities, O'Keefe in Wisconsin and Typert in Idaho. Both had studied at the Art Institute of Chicago under the noted draftsman John Vanderpool. Neither ever went to Europe to study. Both settled in the American West, O'Keefe in New Mexico and Typert in Wyoming, and both painted Western subjects. O'Keefe painted abstract landscapes expressive of her inner feelings, simplifying the forms of adobe buildings and rolling hills. In a very different vein, Minerva Typert painted large figural murals that told stories of the West in a realistic style, as in her painting for the Utah Centennial of 1947 and the four murals in this auditorium. My grandmother had a penchant for telling stories, and she wanted to share them with everyone for their edification and improvement. Because of this, she resonated to the principles of the Beaux-Arts muralists she met in her studies in Chicago and New York. That is why her Western paintings are so different from O'Keefe's. In 1987, when I was doing research for my master's thesis on my grandmother, I spent a week in Coachville with my mother, going through Grandma's library, which was still intact. I wanted to know why she called her paintings murals and why she wanted to paint them. I remember how excited I was to discover a marked up copy of Edwin Howland Blatchfield's Mural Painting in America. Blatchfield was the dean of American mural painting when Grandma was studying art, and the book was a copy of the lectures on mural painting that he gave at the Art Institute of Chicago in 1912 when Grandma was there. Reading that book was like a revelation. I remember running into my mother and saying, "Listen to this, it's Grandma talking." Blatchfield said, "In Athens 2200 years ago, in Rome 1800 years ago, the man who lacked the power or the will or the time to be went to the public buildings to learn history, which he found there painted and sculpted so plainly that he learned without effort. The decoration in a building which belongs to the public must speak to the public, to the man in the street. It must embody thought and significance, and that so plainly that he who runs may be." Minerva Typert internalized this concept and often told her children and grandchildren that her important stories had to be painted so that he who runs may lead. Blatchfield also said, "What is Greek vase painting? Storytelling. What do the walls of Egypt tell us? The same stories of 100 deities 10,000 times repeated. What were the beautiful, simple artistic frescoes of the Italian Trecento? Stories, stories, stories." Now I quote from Grandma's impassioned speeches that she gave after returning to Pocatello from her art study in New York. See if it doesn't sound a little bit like Blatchfield. "What part are we to play in future art? In Assyria, Egyptian, Grecian, and all ancient arts, we read the story of the people in the architecture, sculpture, and mural decoration. Suppose in 2,000 years hence a new people shall unearth Pocatello. Among the books, one is decipherable. Our records will be our building, our sculpture, our mural decoration. We have the story of all ancient America to record. We do not keep these things on golden tablets now, but in our architecture, sculpture, and mural decoration of the future, She was passionate about telling her story in Milk. How are we to understand the term mill painting as she understood it? She embraced Blashfield's concept of mill painting. She envisioned public murals as the perfect form to educate the hurried and those unable to read. When she returned to Idaho from her art study in New York, there was no market for murals in Pocatello. She was, however, hired by the Pocatello medical doctor, Minnie Howard, to paint a frieze around the dining room in the Howard home. The theme was a Western landscape, one of the few pure landscapes ever painted by Tyson. A far cry from the open spaces of the Maynard Simpson landscape, here she celebrates what she called the lacy cottonwood trees of the Snake River region. This frieze will soon grace a reading room in the American Gallery of the BYU Museum of Art. And I have a couple of other pieces of it. It's also very interesting, the very thick paint she used for this, which is not typical of her, and the experimenting she did with the various kinds of brush tools. Here's another panel of that same frieze from Dr. Minnie. And here's another panel. When you think about Beaux-Arts allegorical mural decoration, even when she's painting a Western landscape, in this piece that she did after returning from New York, she's got a satyr in there. She put in that little figure that you can see. Teichert did not receive commissions to paint murals with either religious or Western themes, however, and those were her two chosen subjects. Undaunted, she painted her murals, like the ones in this building, without a commission. In doing so, she seemingly denied her paintings the classification of mural art, because murals are traditionally commissioned for specific locations in designated buildings to enhance and decorate the architecture, like the murals in Dr. Minnie Howard's home. During the Italian Renaissance, mural painting was applied directly to wet plaster in the fresco technique, actually becoming part of the wall.
She never did a thing that she didn't pray about. She had a great faith. And it showed in the beginning to realize what it meant. Every one of her paintings had a great meaning. And it was a meaning of her faith.
Would anybody comment on her interest in genealogy? Did she do quite a bit of genealogy?
Well, yeah. I've got a drawer full of some of the work that are genealogy work.
I think she did a lot. Of course, the Tiger family doesn't... we don't go back on too many generations because my dad... father was born in 1842. He served in the three German wars, unification of Germany under Bismarck, and he didn't want to, my grandfather didn't want to get out of there. He wanted to get out, and he had one child, and he lost his first wife, and married, and decided to come to America so his kids wouldn't have to serve in the German army. But my father was back in World War I, she had a, I don't know. Now what was the question again? Genealogy. But anyhow, goes back about five generations. And I talked to a lot of people, head of the geology department at the University of Kansas is a Tiger. Adolf Tiger is the biggest contractor in California. But we've never been able to tie a lot of these different people. We came from the same area, but we've never been able to tie genealogy in there. So Tucker's line doesn't go back too far. Some of the mother's lines go back quite a ways to the American lines go back to the early pilgrims. But her father's line, and the Westerners were Huguenots, French Huguenots, and a lot of them were raised in castles in southern France, and we drawn about as far as we can, but I'm sure the things have come up so they can Tracy's genealogy before that. I was looking at some of her life, and it was interesting because one of her father's sisters was trying to think of the name right. There was Hubers and different things, but one that married into the Kimmer line. Well, it's Johnny Kimmer over here in Kimmer. And so I had quite a lot of correspondence with him because they were cousins, his wife and my mother. Just trying to follow the line back this way of who they were related to. So she has a lot of genealogy, and I have most of it. But she had it, and she kind of passed that on to me.
I'll tell you the method in my madness in asking that question, is that it seems to me that when people are interested in genealogy, one of the things it does is it starts opening the past. And this isn't some abstraction. These are real people back there, and real people with real stories, and she paints stories. Yes?
I was just making a comment to your wife. They didn't say, nobody said anything about how she worked on genealogy. And I can remember her talking about it. She had a drive to do that also. And she said, it seemed like every time just before she had a breakthrough in finding somebody, she'd have a threat to her health. And then this would be resolved. She was very prayerful, had a lot of faith. This would be resolved, and then she would find a new lead. But I can remember her involvement.
Now, it seems like another job, another thing in the church that she was quite active in was the Sunday school. Isn't that correct? Didn't she work on some Sunday school board or something?
I couldn't remember her lessons to this day.
And I guess what I'm getting at here, this seems like an amazingly congruent person. This interest in the past showing up in her passion for genealogy. This interest in teaching gospel doctrine class. This interest in a neighbor kid walks in the door and she sits him down and starts teaching him art and in between some piano. I mean, this idea of teaching and sharing stories. And if you look around you right here with this art, every bit of it is about teaching. When I look at art schools in our time, the prime focus seems to be about style and maybe some technique. And there is very little discussion of ideas. I don't think Minerva Tyker would be motivated by art in a vacuum. It seems to have a purpose. And her whole life seemed to have a purpose. John.
My mother was not a drum beater for women's rights, but you'll notice that on many of her paintings, even the Indians and others, and the Pioneer painting, the paintings, she emphasizes the role of women in what they were doing. And I think even with the Indian people, Indian women, that she tries to put some, what you would say, the words to even define it, that she emphasized their role and makes it important in what they were doing.
I've got to tell this humorous incident about Mrs. Tiger. We were working one day, I was on the piano bench drawing some of this, and all of a sudden she said, "Oh my, I've got to take lunch out to the men on the roundup. They're going to be at Bear River Bridge and they need lunch. Come and help me." So we went into the kitchen and we hurriedly threw together some sandwiches, and she had some fruit there and other things, and the rest of the story is scary. You ready for the scary part? We went out and got into that little old white and brown Ford that Herman and Minerva had, and I crawled in the passenger side and I could barely see over the dash, and she got in the other side and she couldn't see over the wheel, she was looking through it, and it was parked against the door of that garage right there at the end of the street, and she didn't understand automatic transmission. She knew that someplace in the throw of that gear shift, there was a gear that went forward and one that went backward, and she didn't know where they were. Or at least that was my perception. And she didn't realize that it had to be in either neutral or park in order to start. So she had one hand on the ignition, holding the key, and the other hand on the gear shift, and she was doing this, holding the ignition and pumping it like this. And when it would hit neutral, it would try to start, and when it would hit drive or reverse, lunge one way or the other. And I just knew we were going to go through the door and the wall of that garage. But finally, when she did get it started, she managed to get a foot on the brake long enough to not go through the garage, and then she sort of eased into reverse and figured out where that was. I don't know if she couldn't see the indicator or she just didn't know, but she scared the bejeebers out of me, I'll tell you.
Aunt Minerva was the only one of the three Tykert wives that learned to drive a modern car. My mother, my aunt Edith, and Aunt Minerva all started driving Model T Fords. And when the cars became more modern, my mother and Aunt Edith just gave up and let their husbands do the driving, but Aunt Minerva did drive a car. And we lived on a ranch on a border at one time. It's where Calvin Price and his wife live now. And Webb Hill was a treacherous hill, it still is. And as some of you know, it's claimed some lives to people that are very dear to us here in this room. It was the first storm of winter, and Aunt Minerva came driving into our yard, slammed on the brakes, and came running in the house. And she was, were you with her? Oh, okay. She had both of her hands over her mouth, and blood was running through her fingers. And my mother said, "Minerva, Minerva, what's ever happened?" And she ran straight to the washstand that was in our kitchen. We didn't have modern plumbing, but there was a washstand in the kitchen with a wash basin. And she ran right there to that basin and opened her mouth and spit out her false teeth and a torrent of blood. And my mother got some water for her to rinse her mouth. She'd been driving to Montpelier, and when she started up Webb Hill, it had been snowing and the road was slippery, and she did a 360-degree turn and hit the guardrail. And when she hit the guardrail, her mouth hit the steering wheel. So she turned around immediately and drove back to our ranch. It was about 2 or 3 miles back to our ranch. And she came in there, and my mother helped her. And maybe John can finish the story. I didn't remember that John was with her at the time, but Aunt Minerva did learn to drive, and for those days, she was a good woman driver. She really was. Anything that Aunt Minerva did, she did well, and she did with a great deal of courage. So, yes, she was a determined woman.
Well, my wife would probably disagree on how well she drove, but yes, it's quite good. But I remember this particular incident because the mother dropped me off at Aunt Julie's, and I was at the house when she came back. And I remember Aunt Julie getting hot water bottles and stuff like that because she was kind of in shock and one thing and another, and taking care of her for several hours before we left there.
Could any of you describe what a typical day was like for Minerva Tiger? What did she have any kind of a regular schedule? What was it like? How did she spend a day? What was a typical day like?
I often stayed overnight with Lauren, and there were two bedrooms upstairs in the Tiger home, and the large bedroom was where the boys slept, and Lauren's bedroom was the smaller room. The first thing that we'd hear every morning, and it was still dark, was Uncle Herman's voice, "Boys, I need you at the barn." And we could hear the boys piling out of bed and going down the stairs. The next thing was Aunt Minerva's voice, "Laura Lee, I need you." And Lori and I would get up, and Lori would head to the kitchen to help Aunt Minerva with the work. But Aunt Minerva worked very hard.
And what time was this? What time did she?
Dark. Dark. I don't know what time. It was just really dark, and the bed felt nice and warm, and we girls didn't want to climb out of it, but there was work to be done. And the day started early. But Aunt Minerva's day revolved around her painting. There was always a painting on the wall. Someone says they remember her house smelling like apple pie. I remember her house smelling like turpentine. And there was always a painting on the wall, and there was always, she called it the library table, it was always piled high with artist supplies. And when she could walk in that room and take a few strokes on that canvas, she did. And she didn't neglect her family, but housework and cooking meals were not her top priority. Her top priority was her artwork. But she had other responsibilities. She raised a huge vegetable garden. She took care of her chickens. She took care of the milk house. And so her day started at dark, and it went all day long, working as hard as she could all day long, seeing that everything that had to be done got done. But in the meantime, she painted. She painted all day long, from morning to night, in between what else she was doing.
You mean, but like small chunks of time, like 5 or 10 minutes even?
30 seconds. If she could get 30 seconds to go over and put a few dabs of paint on her canvas, she did. And quite often there was something simmering on the back of the stove that might be a kettle of beans. And when the family came in and they were hungry, help yourself, the beans are on the stove. And she would go right on painting if she possibly could. Her painting, her whole life revolved around her painting, and that's what she did. She didn't neglect anybody, but she put as little time as possible in the cooking and housework. And Lois Staten will remember this, that one time she had invited Bishop Dayton and his family to come to dinner. She invited them the week before. And on Sunday, they walked in, and Aunt Minerva greeted them and asked them to sit down. And after they'd sat there a while, she said, "My goodness, I wish I had known you were coming. I'd have fixed you something to eat." And I said, "Well, last week you invited us to sit to dinner."
She didn't know, mother didn't remember that until after they'd gone. Then it finally dawned on her that she invited them to dinner. Dad had said, "We had, you should have come earlier. We had ice cream." But in answer to this, I got something I wrote down here some time ago, a typical Minerva Tucker's day. She was always up early to build a fire on the stove before calling the children. If she woke real early, she might paint for an hour, or make a sketch or something, sketch of something she got the inspiration of to do during the night. She prepared that breakfast while we did chores. Generally, breakfast consisted of a cooked cereal, bacon powder biscuits, and they were good. The bacon powder biscuits were excellent. Fried eggs, sometimes soft boiled or poached, fried potatoes, and an orange or fruit. She figured we had to start out the day. We had to start the day off with a hearty breakfast, but we generally had a couple of hours of work in before we ate, so we were ready for it. After dishes, she took care of the beds, chickens, and worked in the milk house. There wasn't much time for painting in the morning. There was always interruptions, people coming for eggs and cream. While we ate breakfast, she often read to us. Although most of the reading took place in the evenings after chores were completed, she always had chickens, and until 1944, we ran the town dairy. And she did all the washing, the separated and stuff and such as that. After chores, she would either paint, work in the yard and garden, or do genealogy. Often there were lunches to prepare for a hanging crew or those going on around. Generally, there wasn't much time to paint before lunch. And I think that probably pretty well covers a typical day.
Tell us about her teaching your 1 or 8 year meals. She always read to you.
Well, I did mention that she read particularly in the evening. I said we had the family home meeting every day. We ate a lot of stews and soups and stuff like that, and Dad would generally come in because he had that cattle out at the little, what we call the dwelling place, and he had to ride out there after the chores and feed the cattle out there and then come back. And so he was about, generally about 3:30 before he came in, and she'd always have a warm stew on the table and ready for him when he came. But we, in having the dairy, we didn't deliver in the day in the morning. We always delivered the milk at night to the people around town. But we also had range cattle with Dad and range herd. And I think my folks, you know, during the Depression, they prospered during the Depression. That was a tough time that when it came on. And for me and Dad, they bought ground over east of Bear Lake, and they got it for, well, a lot of that for taxes. It cost them 10 times, 100 times what they paid for it now. One thing I should say about my mother, she was besides always problem come up, but she'd always say, let's pray about it. But she had always had a lot of inspiration of and depend upon the Lord for things. And I know that Herman, you know, when she went to Coquille Hunter, they courted several girls around, you know, and he was a branch president over in Pegram and had to go over there. But she dreamed Beulah before she ever came to Coquille. And when she walked in, she knew that was going to be Herman's wife. And I don't know if I had anything quite that direct, but I remember when Mother was painting down in the Nanti Temple, this has been kind of personal with me, but I was going with a girl from the colonies down in Mexico. She was the niece of President Romney. And the mother got up and she had a dream, and she wrote me at midnight on a postcard. And she saw me falling down the stairs of the Nanti Temple. She was painting there. And she said, I don't know what it means, but she just let me know that she was the concerns and what had been revealed there. But I knew what was going, and we'd been out, probably got just a little friendlier than we should have. And I took it anyhow, and I knew that she wanted to get married. I knew I should go on a mission, and I think I had a class from Brother U.B. Brown. I'd always been kind of a skeptic, I guess, but I had a class from Brother U.B. Brown at the, and while I got in there, because an upper division class, I was a sophomore, but he laid out the gospel so logically, and I knew that I had to, where I had to go and what I had to do, and I wasn't, and marriage wasn't a part of it at that time.
Just one little comment about the cooking. My contemporaries of the Tigard family, Bryant and Ron and their older siblings and Hamilton's children, when Grandma Tigard would say, come on in and I'll feed you some lunch, they'd say, oh no, we're going home for lunch. They'd say, our grandma is the worst cook in the world.
Except her biscuits were good.
The biscuits were good. I remember a lot of days sitting there drawing and helping on the borders on the paintings, and lunchtime would come around and I'd say, oh, I better go home and have some lunch. And she said, no, we're not finished. You just stay here. And she'd go get some of those leftover biscuits from breakfast, and we'd have homemade butter and honey on those biscuits, and oh, that was a great lunch. But in the meantime, the roast was burning in the oven.
The farmer in me wants to ask a question about the gardening and the chickens and the milk. How big was the garden? How many chickens were there, and how many cows did you milk?
We probably had 100 chickens. And Mother was pretty close. And when she was homesteading, she lived in Idaho, right? Warm Springs. Well, I guess it's earlier than that. She lived in the
sheriff of Bingham County, she had a mess in the slot. She was with the campus to go to the shooting guy. Telling him, so she could hit at any time. But when she's out homesteading, she had a six-year-old, she had a number of people, she kept running the cabin all the time. And she didn't mention the shot. Because I remember there was a chicken hawk coming flying around up there, but he had a full deal, she didn't